counsel, the gentleman over there with a suit on.
That's why he required the introduction.
That's right.
You didn't have to purchase that for him.
I think he's going from here to a bar mitzvah for a funeral or something.
So according now to the presence, Mr. Atkins.
This is an appeal from a from two orders of the court, the district court below. The first order was a dismissal of the count one of a complaint under Title VII. The dismissal was based solely on the McDonald case that this court issued about 5 years ago. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the dismissal order. We feel that under in view of this court's prior holdings and the Supreme Court's recent holding in the unpronounceable case that that really adopted this court's prior ruling, there was certainly more than enough alleged in the complaint to get beyond a motion to dismiss. It was not just the McDonald case. It was not just the fact that there was an overly exuberant investigation. The allegations were that the investigation itself was started with a predetermined idea to discipline these individuals. We alleged the so-called invidious list, which showed that white males were being treated completely different in disciplinary cases than any others. And we also alleged other material that goes along with the McDonald.
Did you engage in any type of investigation to substantiate the allegations in the invidious list?
Yes, I did, Your Honor. I talked to the individual who actually compiled it. Now, that's outside the record, but we did have that that individual, and there was an investigation conducted by the DEA, not to determine if there was any problem, but to find out who actually compiled that list. The list that's attached to our in our appendix is only partial. I mean, this was a...
Let me tell you my problem with that, and maybe you can help me with it, because the invidious list apparently sets out allegations of differential treatment, but it's unsworn, and none of the agents seem to have provided any sworn corroboration of...
Well,
you know, the alleged facts.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if that were, we're talking at the pleading stage now. Had we gotten our gotten to go beyond the pleading stage, we could have done more, much more, and brought more people in and done some discovery along those lines. The government has adopted the invidious list as apparently our answer to their non-invidious reasons for taking the action they did. The invidious list is more addressed to the complaint on sexual discrimination rather than the retaliation. We do not contest that they had a right to put these agents on administrative leave. If you'll recall, if I can put, now I'm talking about the retaliation. On April 5th, well, first of all, in March, the middle of March, these agents filed informal charges of sexual and racial discrimination. The informal process was going along when on April 5th, the individual police officers from Madison and elsewhere filed their sexual discrimination case against the five individuals, the five agents. At that time, they were placed on administrative leave. The government, in their affidavits, in their declarations, it's all in the appendix, the government said the reason they were placed on administrative leave was because of the, quote, media blitz and the fact that they might possibly embarrass the government, or they might possibly be lost their effectiveness in Chicago. The special agent in charge in Chicago, of course, was never asked about that. They were just placed on administrative leave, which in itself was being treated differently from other people. There was evidence, and we alleged that others charged with much more serious sexual discrimination were not placed on administrative leave, didn't have their gun taken away, didn't have their credentials taken away. Be that as it may, let's even give them that the administrative leave was valid and rational. 2 days later, they transferred them to the four corners of the earth. Now, why did they transfer them at that time? The government and the DEA says, we transferred them for the good of the service and for the good of the individuals involved. because of the media blitz and because of the identical reasons that they had given 2 days earlier to place them on administrative leave. Now, we all know that the, and in fact, the record is clear, that all of this media blitz was engendered by the people who filed the lawsuit. The lawyers called a news conference. They gave it to a wire service referred to as the PR wire service. PR to me means public relations. And by the way, the news conference, the television conference, and all of the material that was turned over by the attorneys for the plaintiffs in the Markham case engendered a lawsuit for libel and slander and a complaint to the Wisconsin Bar Association by these very individuals, my clients, the five agents. The Stone case says that if you're doing, to get, we're not talking about direct evidence, although I think we could if we wanted to, but let's stay with...
Okay, let's talk about what we could if we wanted to, because what we really need, Mr. Shippers, well, is where in the record is the evidence that will support these contentions?
All right, I will run it through. To support their contention that they were treated, that they were singled out and that they were treated differently and retaliated against, it is necessary under Stone for us to show, bring evidence for it, that either there was some suspicious, strange actions at the level of the management, their reasons were not rational, or that they were contradicting each other, or that these individuals were treated differently from other people who hadn't filed charges, hadn't filed sexual discrimination charges. Director Constantine said this was just another case. Didn't mean a thing. It was just and this is all in our appendix, or in our in the record at 71. Not just another case. Mr. Green says, Phelps kept me advised periodically, and I in turn kept Mr. Constantine advised. Tom Byrne, who was the OPR chief at that time, says that it was a significant case, so that they had at a biweekly meeting, it was brought up and it was discussed thoroughly with Mr. Constantine. That in itself is different from the usual run-of-the-mill case.
Let me just read from the reply brief. What you say is this: all five plaintiffs have personal knowledge of other agents who were accused of serious sexual harassment, but were neither transferred, placed on administrative leave, or disciplined. Three of those situations were specifically identified.
That's correct, Judge.
Now, that's the extent of the discussion. Where?
Oh, they were identified in the in Mr. Kuchster's affidavit, which I think is about 7 or 8 in Appendix 71, which is our set of documents. They all, every one of these agents said they had personal knowledge of other cases in which sexual discrimination did not result in administrative leave, did not result in transfers. Now let's talk about the next one. The people from Washington testified in their own case that there was nobody that they knew who had ever been transferred while on administrative leave. Our agents were transferred while on administrative leave. And the evidence is clear that the transfers came. They announced at about noon or 1 o'clock on the 10th that they were going to go formal on their charges. At 6:11 that night, the first transfer orders came out, sending Kuchster to San Francisco and the rest of them to other places. Less than 2 days later, after midnight, On the 11th, it was the very early hours of the 11th, the transfers were changed to move them to different locations. Now, for the benefit of the government, they spent $500,000 to move these four agents, one of whom was going to retire in 7 months, and the others, another one was sent to Newark where there was no opening. He had to sit and do jobs that had nothing to do with what he was able to do. And originally, they were going to send Kuchster to San Francisco for his last 7 months.
Is there something peculiar about San Francisco that makes it really outstandingly bad? Or
I don't think I'd like to comment on that, Judge, but I...
No, you kind of...
It wasn't so much...
You said it with venom in your voice, and I was curious.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because it's with a fellow who's under 7 months. The testimony was that it is the rule, it is the policy not to transfer him at all. So they send them, they want to send them.
San Francisco is not any different than any other city.
Well, except it's 2,000 miles further.
Than Chicago, you mean.
That's right. They were the only agents who were given only 45 days to move. They were required to go house hunting without gun, badge, or credentials. It was only when Joe Vannacora, the sack here in Chicago, begged Washington that they allowed them to have their creds. They were not allowed to take their gun and badge at all. It was routine, and Joe Vannacora testified to this, it was routine for them to get extensions if they needed it. All of the extensions were denied except Flanagan's, and the only reason Flanagan got an extension was because Vannacora called out and begged to get him an extension.
The agency takes the position that the invidious list, if it is to be relied on at all, doesn't contain similarly situated people. What's your response to that?
It does contain similarly. Our evidence doesn't show.
No, the agency position, as I understand it, is that the invidious list, though they would argue shouldn't be relied on at all for reasons of hearsay, but let's not dwell on that for the moment. They say they don't match up as similarly situated to the plaintiffs.
Judge, we're not using the invidious list on the retaliation end of this. I'm not relying on the invidious list.
Oh, just for discrimination?
I'm relying on direct testimony that's in the record, either by government officials or by my own clients or by others. One of the government officials said, oh, others were transferred with only 45 days. But Mr. Andrasco, the man who was charged with actually ordering the transfers, said that the four agents were the only ones ever required to move in 45 days. They were the only ones who were never not allowed to discuss the charges against them with anybody. They were told they couldn't talk to anybody.
You want to save some time for rebuttal?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Jeff.
I don't want to cut you off.
No, but I think the rest is pretty well laid out in the briefs, and there are just double every time you look at something that was done to these people, even the way they can't. Well, it's in the brief.
Thank you, Mr. Shipley. Mr. Himmelfarb?
May it please the Court, my name is Edward Himmelfarb with the Department of Justice. The central focus of the appeal here is whether DEA was lying when it gave its justification for these transfers. And that justification was that the agents, in the determination of the DEA, had lost their effectiveness in Chicago, and that DEA's relationship with state and local law enforcement also could be compromised. And so the decision was made that the best thing for everybody involved, and the agency obviously looking out for its own interests too, was to transfer them to different places and not to have them running these same training programs in Chicago where a lot of the local law enforcement people were coming, because obviously, and who's going to send women to these training programs after these charges would have been nationally aired the way they had been?
What evidence did you present to demonstrate that the decision to give only 45 days to report to their new duty stations was unrelated to the situation and further had been had been contemplated prior to it?
Well, that's the testimony of Stephen Green, who was the deputy administrator of DEA. He gave a statement.
I know what he said. What's the evidence? I can't get anyone to give me evidence.
Well, there really isn't a lot of evidence one way or the other. I would say in passing that Mr. Andrasco, who said that they were the only ones transferred on administrative leave, I believe that was a statement said actually to the best of his recollection. So nobody's really sure about this. But what Mr. Green said was that there had been within contemplation of DEA a shortening of the normal 90 days of transfer to 45 days because they had found that some of the agents that it took too long to get agents into new places, and agents are transferred reasonably frequently, and then they shortened it to 45 for a period of about 3 months. That Mr. Green's recollection was that there were actually other agents who were transferred within that 45-day, within the 3-month periods under the 45-day rule, and that because there had been a lot of complaining about this shortening of the rule, they changed it back.
General Farm, if I could focus a little bit more on the transfer. I understand the department's position is that the DEA feels that veteran agents such as we have here could not or should not participate in the training programs, at least during the period of investigation. I think that's what you said. It would be inappropriate and it might affect relations.
I think, Your Honor, I believe what I said was they shouldn't be involved in the training program after the investigation.
Right. Well, whatever. I didn't mean to.
Oh,
I don't want to mischaracterize.
They were transferred and then they were moved out after the investigation.
Yeah. What does the transfer have to do? Why couldn't the same... They be isolated from training here during the period of investigation? And how does transferring him to another locale... I can understand putting him in some ELBA where they have no contact with law enforcement or another office. But how when you remove him from this site, you withdraw him from training activity. What were they to do in the department's view, or the DEA's view, I mean, all part of the department? What were they to do in the new locale that wouldn't also damage relations with, unless they were isolated again from law enforcement? Outside law enforcement.
Your Honor, I don't think it was a question of isolating them from law enforcement. The question was, should they be running these programs that drew students from local law enforcement? The complainants in this case, the women were local law enforcement, and they came to these programs
but
in Chicago.
So you back them out of those programs. They are no longer trainers during the period of investigation. What is gained? How is the public good, whether the department, the agency, or relations with local law enforcement aided by them now being located in other venues?
Well, because A, they weren't all together at that point, and B, they weren't in Chicago where all of the damage had occurred.
Was there any evidence before the district court that openings existed closer to Chicago, but that the agents nevertheless were transferred to these distant locations?
No, I don't believe there was. I believe that the testimony was that DEA, when it decided to transfer the agents, looked. In fact, that seems to have been the reason for the change, the 2-day change in the locations of the transfers. They tried to come up with available slots. These were relatively high-ranking officials in DEA, senior officials, and they had to find something that was comparable and opening in other places. In fact, one of the complaints is that when the agents reached Newark, there wasn't a position open, and that was what they were doing there. Replacing somebody who was on extended disability leave, and they were putting him in place of him. But the reason that they picked these locations is that's where they found the slots available at a comparable level.
So you're going to place them. You're concerned about their having relations with local law enforcement in a training thing.
Particularly in
and
training
you remove
context,
them.
Yes,
you want to place them in comparable, responsible positions in new locales?
Well, they were comparable. They didn't necessarily involve training. And sure, you could. You know, when you have contact with local law enforcement, in a training program, it's going to be somewhat different from what your contact is in the ordinary course of doing DEA work. And I guess what DEA was thinking, what can be done about this bad situation? And maybe there's no perfect answer, but I think what they tried to do, and I think what the testimony reflects, is they tried to come up with the best possible solution to this problem that they had found themselves in.
Is it easier to conduct the investigation of these individuals when they're scattered from the venue of where the alleged harassment occurred?
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to try to clarify because the timing is important here. The complaints about this training program came into DEA in summer and fall of 94. The investigation was started. It was expanded. The whole investigation took about 6 months, and the Office of Inspections transmitted its report about the third or fourth week of March to Washington. The lawsuit was filed, I believe it was April 5th, and with all the publicity. The decision to put them in administrative leave was April 7th. That was a Friday. The April 10th, Monday, they were transferred, next business day. Now, the investigation had already been completed at that point. So the transfer really didn't have anything to do with furthering the, or didn't hurt furthering the investigation, because the investigation was essentially finished at that point, and what remained to be done was to decide, for the DEA to decide what to propose for discipline. The transfer, of course, was unrelated to discipline. These agents did have proposed discipline ranging from,
What in the record will conclusively tell us that the transfers were unrelated to discipline?
The transfer, I'm sorry, Your Honor, that they're unrelated to discipline?
Yes.
Well, transfers are not disciplinary in their very nature, but they're not, Your Honor. Let me say one thing, because DEA agents are transferred all the time for a lot of different reasons, just for furthering their career and for the good of the agency, and that continues to be the case.
Did these transfers further the careers of these agents?
Well, it certainly helped the DEA, that much we know, and that's certainly a legitimate reason for transferring the agent. Now, Your Honor, I think, going back to the original question, the way the McDonnell-Douglas test works, when the agency comes up with the non-discriminatory justification, which we have done, it becomes the agent's burden to show that that's a lie. Now, whether it's clear and absolutely clear on the record or not that this is the agency's that the agency's justification was actually correct, it's their obligation to show that it was a lie, that was not the actual reason for their transfer. They have not done that. So the burden really is on the plaintiffs at that point. It's not our burden. We came up with a justification, a non-discriminatory justification. Now they have to show that that's a false justification.
How much
lie.
Time did Judge Bucklow give you for discovery?
I don't believe there's actual discovery in the case. I believe the case, there was a motion to dismiss, and part of the case was dismissed, as we know. Then a summary judgment motion was made, and my recollection is that the plaintiffs did not ask for discovery, but I'm not absolutely sure about that. I don't believe there was any discovery at the point of the summary judgment motion. It was done on the papers, on affidavits, and on the sworn statements taken by the investigators.
What's the time frame between the completion of the investigation, as you stated, Mr. Himmelfarb, and the transfers?
Well, the completion, I think maybe more accurately we should talk about the transmittal of the investigation, because my understanding is that there was a slight lag between the completion of the investigation and the time it was transmitted. It was transmitted, I believe the record shows it was transmitted on March 23rd. I don't know when it actually arrived in Washington. The transfers occurred on April 10th.
Yeah. Now, in an agency where transfers are normal, I mean, it's a nationwide international agency, but are you suggesting then they have to really have the smoking gun of someone announcing that this transfer was at the summary judgment stage, not for the good of the agency, but for disciplinary agents? Reasons. I mean, you've got to. I appreciate what you're suggesting with the McDonnell-Douglas burden shifting, and transfer is always going to be an appropriate action, or not always, but it should be an appropriate action for an agency. But unless you're suggesting that their evidence must indicate that somebody specifically said it, I guess the issue I'm concerned about is the timing. You're saying timing couldn't be
timing actually works in our favor, because what happened was the lawsuit was filed, and they had to do something very quickly to quell the disturbance that this was causing, and this is what they did. I think everybody understands that the federal government doesn't necessarily turn on the dime, unfortunately, and they just had to do something quickly here. And that's the reason for the quick transfers. Later on, a week or two later, they decided what to do in terms of discipline for these agents, and they proposed discipline for the various agents. But the transfers were done shortly after the national publicity for this lawsuit that caused so much harm, or DEA perceived it to have a lot of harm to its mission. I'd be happy to talk a little bit about the discrimination claim if the court has questions about that.
Bill, you have any?
You can talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Well, if the court has no questions about that, I'd be happy to rely on the briefs. Thank you very much.
Mr. Shepard.
Every difficulty that Mr. Himmelfarb raised as a reason for transfer was accomplished by the administrative leave. They were taken out of the office, they were not permitted in any DEA office, their guns, badges, and credentials were taken away, and they were sent home. They were not involved in anything about the DEA from that point on. The timing is the word. They announced at noon that they were filing formal charges, and 6 hours later they were transferred to the four corners of the world. That's the timing. I think to show the animus, to show the almost pathological animus of the DEA, you need only look at Mr. Flanagan. He had just adopted three little blonde, blue-eyed Russian children. He was sent to the border in Texas, and he lived a life of hell on earth from that point on. He put in for transfers and for promotions 300 times. 300 times. He was on the best qualified list every single time. SACs around the country were asking for him. But he was not moved and he was not promoted because, in the appendix it shows, the Chicago problem. Mike Flanagan hadn't said a word. He hadn't done a thing. And the last but not least, if you balkanize each individual thing, you may be able to say, well, the transfer wasn't necessarily objectionable. This wasn't objectionable. That wasn't objectionable. When you look at the litany of what they did to these four men, you will see that there was a deliberate, conscious effort to retaliate against them and to punish them for their actions.
Mr. Chivers, following up on Judge Rovner's question, what discovery did you take or was requested or permitted at the trial level?
We really didn't need any discovery because the FBI did an excellent job in the EEO complaint. They talked to everybody. We had affidavits coming out our ears, and we had the other stuff from the investigation. By the way, they withheld the investigative file on the EEO for 3.5 years so that they could sanitize it. They also, when they were charged on April 19th, they first of all refused to let them share it with their attorney, the investigative file. And then when they finally sent them all the material out, it was in boxes thrown in a pile. Joe Vanacore testified it took three secretaries 3 days just to put it in order. They had 10 days to reply. Thank you.
I have to ask you then. All right. Thank you, Mr. Shippers, Mr. Ackerman, Mr. Himmelfarb. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under
good-looking suit, too.